Hello and welcome to, believe it or not, the 52nd episode in our long pilgrimage and path to Rome with Hilaire Belloc. Yes, we've been doing this for a year. In fact, I looked at the first time we recorded, 18th of June of last year. So there's must have been a couple of weeks when we didn't have the path to Rome. I'm not aware of ever missing a week, ever. Maybe we did something else instead. Or maybe I did miss a couple of weeks. I suppose everybody's entitled to a holiday, right? So anyway, we are almost there. It took Belloc, I think, about 6 weeks. It's taken us over a year. So today he continues his trudge southwards, getting closer and closer to Rome. And of course, as we know, he waxes eloquent and tangential on things as he's walking, and this is very psychologically real. Of course, any of you that have done long distance walks, long distance hikes, long distance pilgrimages on foot know you have plenty of time to think and to pray. It's one of the beauties of it. So these tangential thoughts psychologically would be exactly the way this would happen. You'd be walking forward, but your mind would be wandering in all sorts of different directions. So today we've got a discussion of how to write and the story of someone called Mr. Hard. So, without further ado, returning to The Path to Rome by Hilaire Belloc. But when, after several miles of climbing, I neared the summit, it was already beginning to be light. The bareness and desert grey of the distance I had crossed stood revealed in a colourless dawn. Only the Mount Amiata, now somewhat to the northward, was more gentle and softened the scene with distant woods. Between it and this height ran a vague riverbed as dry as the stones of a salt beach. The sun rose as I passed under the ruined walls of the castle. In the little town itself, early as was the hour, many people were stirring. One gave me good morning, a man of singular character, for here, in the very peep of day, he was sitting on a doorstep, idle, lazy and contented, as though it was full noon. Another was yoking oxen, a third going out singing to work in the fields. I did not linger in this crow's nest, but going out by the low and aged southern gate, another deeper valley, even drier and more dead than the last, appeared under the rising sun. It was enough to make one despair. And when I thought of the day's sleep in that wilderness, of the next night's toil through it, Lector, what about the brigand of Radicofani, of whom you spoke in Lorraine, and of whom I am waiting to hear? Auctor, what about him? Why, he was captured long ago, and has since died of old age. I am surprised that you are interrupting me with such questions. Pray, ask for no more tales till we get to the really absorbing story of the hungry student. Well, as I was saying, I was in some despair at the sight of that valley, which had to be crossed before I could reach the town of Acqua Pendente, or Hanging Water, which I knew to lie somewhere on the hills beyond. The sun was conquering me, and I was looking hopelessly for a place to sleep, when a cart drawn by two oxen at about 1 mile an hour came creaking by. The driver was asleep, his head on the shady side. The devil tempted me, and without one struggle against temptation, nay, with cynical and congratulatory feelings, I jumped up behind and put my head also on the shady side. There were soft sacks for a bed. I very soon was pleasantly asleep. We lay side by side for hour after hour, and the day rose on to noon. The sun beat upon our feet, but our heads were in the shade, and we slept heavily, a good and honest sleep. He thinking that he was alone, but I knowing that I was in company, a far preferable thing, and I was right and he was wrong. And the heat grew, and sleep came out of the hot sun more surely than it does out of the night air in the north. But no dreams wander under the noon. From time to time, one or the other of us would open our eyes drowsily and wonder, but sleep was heavy on us both, and our minds were sunk in calm like old hulls in the dark depths of the sea where there are no storms. We neither of us really woke until, at the bottom of the hill which rises into Acqua Pendente, the oxen stopped. This halt woke us up, first me and then my companion. He looked at me a moment and laughed. He seemed to have thought all this while that I was some country friend of his who had taken a lift, and I, for my part, had made more or less certain that he was a good fellow who would do me no harm. I was right, and he was wrong. I knew not what offering to make him to compensate him for this trouble which his heavy oxen had taken. After some thought, I brought a cigar out of my pocket, which he smoked with extreme pleasure. The oxen, meanwhile, had been urged up the slow hill, and it was in this way that we reached the famous town of Acqua Pendente. But why it should be called famous is more than I can understand. It may be that in one of those narrow streets there is a picture of a church or one of those things which so attract unbelieving men. To the pilgrim, it is simply a group of houses. Into one of these I went, and upon my soul, I have nothing to say of it except that they furnished me with food. I do not pretend to have counted the flies, though they were numerous, and even had I done so, what interest would the number have, save to the statisticians? Now, as these are patient men and foolish, I heartily recommend them to go and count the flies for themselves. Leaving this mill then, this town and this people, which were all of a humdrum sort, and going out by the gate, the left side of which is made up of a church, I went a little way on the short road to San Lorenzo, but I had no intention of going far, for, as you know by this time, the night had become my day and the day my night. I found a stream running very sluggish between tall trees, and then this sight sufficiently reminded me of my own country to permit repose. Lying down there, I slept till the end of the day, or rather, to that same time of evening which had now become my usual waking hour. And now tell me, lector, shall I leave out altogether, or shall I give you some description of the next few miles to San Lorenzo? Lector, why, if I were you, I would put the matter short and simply, for it is the business of one describing a pilgrimage, or any other matter, not to puff himself up with vain conceit, nor to be always picking about for picturesque situations, but to set down plainly and shortly what he has seen and heard describing the whole matter. Auctor, but remember, lector, that the artist is known not only by what he puts in, but by what he leaves out. Lector, that is all very well for the artist, but you have no business to meddle with such people. Auctor, how then would you write such a book if you had the writing of it? Lector, I would not introduce myself at all. I would not tell stories at random, nor go in for long descriptions of emotions, which I am sure other men have felt as well as I. I would be careful to visit those things my readers had already heard of. Auctor, the pictures, the remarkable pictures, all that is meant by culture, the brown photographs. Oh, lector, indeed I have done you a wrong. I would certainly not have had the bad taste to say anything upon religion. Above all, I would be terse. Auctor, I see. You would not pile words one on the other, qualifying, exaggerating, conditioning, superlativing, diminishing, connecting, amplifying, condensing, mouthing and glorifying the mere sound. You would be terse. You would be known for your self-restraint. There should be no verbosity in your style, God forbid, still less pomposity, animosity, curiosity, or ferocity. You would have it neat, exact, and scholarly, and above all, chiselled to the nail. A fig, say you, the pip of a fig, for the rambling style. You would be led into no hilarity, charity, vulgarity, or barbarity. Eh, my jolly lector? You would simply say what you had to say. Lector, precisely. I would say a plain thing in a plain way. Auctor, so you think one can say a plain thing in a plain way? You think that words mean nothing more than themselves, and that you can talk without ellipsis, and that customary phrases have not their connotations. You think that, do you? Listen then to the tale of Mr. Benjamin Franklin Hard, a kindly merchant of Cincinnati, O, who had no particular religion, but who had accumulated a fortune of $600,000, and who had a horror of breaking the Sabbath. He was not a kind husband and a good father, but he was unmarried, nor had he any children. But he was all that those words connote. The man Hard, at the age of 54, retired from business and determined to treat himself to a visit to Europe. He had not been in Europe 5 weeks before, he ran bang up against the Catholic Church. He was never more surprised in his life. I do not mean that I have exactly weighed all his surprises all his life through. I mean that he was very much surprised indeed, and that is all that these words connote. He studied the Catholic Church with extreme interest. He watched High Mass at several places, hoping it might be different. He thought it was what it was not, and then, contrarywise, he thought that it was not what it was. He talked to poor Catholics, rich Catholics, middle-class Catholics, and elusive, well-born, penniless, neatly dressed, successful Catholics. Also to pompous, vain Catholics, humble, uncertain Catholics, sneaking, pad-footed Catholics, healthy, howling, combative Catholics, doubtful, shoulder-shrugging, but devout Catholics, fixed, crabbed, and dangerous Catholics, easy, jovial, and shone upon by the heavenly light Catholics, subtle Catholics, strange Catholics, and qua tibi manifeste absurdum videtur, intellectual, pince-nez, jejune, twisted, analytical, yellow, cranky, and introspective Catholics. In fine, he talked to all Catholics. And when I say all Catholics, I do not mean that he talked to every individual Catholic, but that he got a good integrative grip of the church militant with all that the words connote. Well, this man Hard got to know, among others, a certain good priest that loved a good bottle of wine, a fine deep dish of poulet à la casserole, and a kind of egg done with cream in a little platter. And eating such things, this priest said to him one day, "Mr. Hard, what you want is to read some books on Catholicism." And Hard, who was on the point of being received into the church as the final solution of human difficulties, thought it would be a very good thing to instruct his mind before baptism. So he gave the priest a note to a bookseller, whom an American friend had told him of, and this American friend had said, "You will find Mr. Fingal," for such was the bookseller's name, "a hard-headed, honest businessman. He can say a plain thing in a plain way." "Here," said Mr. Hard to the priest, "is £10. Send it to this bookseller Fingal, and he shall choose books on Catholicism to that amount. And you shall receive them, and I will come and read them here with you." So the priest sent the money, and in 4 days the books came back. And Mr. Hard and the priest opened the package, and these were the books inside: Auricular Confession, a History, by A Brand Saved from the Burning; Isabella, or the Little Female Jesuit, by Hepzibah; Elisha McNab, A Tale of the French Huguenots; England and Rome, by the Reverend Ebenezer Catchpole of Emmanuel, Birmingham; Nuns and Nunneries, by Ruth, with preface by Miss Karen, lately returned from a Canadian convent; History of the Inquisition, by Lorente; The Beast with Seven Heads, or the Apocalyptical Warning; No Truce with the Vatican; The True Cause of Irish Disaffection; Decline of the Latin Nations; Anglo-Saxons, the Chosen Race and Their Connection with the 10 Lost Tribes, with a map. Finally, a very large book on the bottom of the case called Giant Pope. And it was no use asking for the money back or protesting. Mr. Fingal was an honest, straightforward man who said a plain thing in a plain way. They had left him to choose a suitable collection of books on Catholicism, and he had chosen the best he knew. And thus did Mr. Hard, who has recently given a hideous font to the new Catholic Church at Bismarckville, learn the importance of estimating what words connote. Lector. But all that does not excuse an intolerable prolixity. Auctor. Neither did I say it did, dear lector. My object was merely to get you to San Lorenzo, where I bought that wine, and where, going out of the gate on the south, I saw suddenly the wide lake of Bolsena all below. It is a great sheet, like a sea, but as one knows one is on a high plateau, and as there is but a short dip down to it, as it is round and has all about it a rim of low, even hills, therefore one knows it for an old and gigantic crater now full of pure water, and there were islands in it, and palaces on the islands. Indeed, it was an impression of silence and recollection, for the water lay all upturned to heaven, and in the sky above me, the moon at her quarter hung still pale in the daylight, waiting for glory. What absolutely glorious prose. Belloc at his best. And I hope you agree with me. Certainly if you've been with me for the last year, I presume that you do. Okay, and without further ado, as this has been a longer than usual episode, I will say adieu. Belloc's getting closer and closer to the Eternal City, and we'll continue with him on the path to Rome next week. Thank you for joining me in the Home is Where the Hearth is podcast. Please do join me next week. Until then, goodbye and God bless.